Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. More at alyeskapipeline.com.
Hi, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your guest host, Ava White. If you listen to Alaska Morning News, you might know me as your host and a business reporter. I'm a journalist here at Alaska Public Media, and I report on statewide news stories and economics and trends. But today, I'm talking about a topic that's very important to me personally, eating disorders. And later, we'll also be talking about GLP-1s, a type of weight loss drug, and how those impact people with disordered eating. I'm joined today with two guests, Caroline Storm, the board chair for the Alaska Eating Disorder Alliance, or AKEDA, and Abby Kuhn, who's in peer support and is here to share her lived experience. And a note, this is a pre-recorded show, so you won't be able to call in or email with your questions, but I'm so thrilled you're listening. Caroline, Abby, thank you so much for joining me. I'm so excited to be having this conversation. I think we should start off very broad. Caroline, what is AKEDA? And can you talk a little bit about your role and what you guys do?
Yeah, thanks. It's really nice to be here. Thanks for having us. AKEDA is primarily a resource organization. We provide training and resources for providers. We lead support groups for people in recovery and for family support. We offer peer navigation for families needing help with themselves or a loved one, and assistance trying to figure out what they need to do. We provide a school-based training program for educators called Building Body Confident Kids. And we were founded in 2019 because of the lack of resources available to families and individuals and the huge gaps in specialized care in Alaska. I've been with AKEDA for 4 years. We were co-founded in 2019. And I currently serve as the board chair.
Can you remind listeners what AKEDA stands for?
Yes, AKEDA is the Alaska Eating Disorders Alliance.
And so before we really dive into the conversation, I think it's really important to say that eating disorders look different. There's no right or wrong way to, describe an eating disorder. And they can impact both men and women. Abby, whatever you're comfortable sharing, I'm curious if you can tell us a little bit about your experience with eating disorders.
Yeah, thanks for asking and thanks for having me here. Looking at my experience, I can see that food and my body were really just in this arena where a much deeper struggle was playing out. And so my eating disorder truly was an attempt to cope with different emotions I had or experiences that felt overwhelming. And it really offered a structure in my life when things felt uncertain or I felt anxious, especially when I felt like I didn't have a sense of control and everything fell out of my hands. It was a really great way for it to help me survive during a difficult time. But really over time, what once felt protective slowly felt like I was a prisoner of my own mind. And from the outside, my life really looked successful. I was serving in the Air Force as an officer, able to have good relationships and accomplish goals and functions in ways that suggested I was doing really, really well. But internally, through my mind, it was just consumed with movement and my body and food. And it all occupied so much of my space that there was really little mental room that I can just simply live. So that's where the journey to recovery came into play. And it hasn't just been about changing my relationship with food. It's also been learning how to feel safe when I needed something else other than my eating disorder to get me there.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. And like I had said a couple of minutes ago, eating disorders can look like so many different things. Caroline, what might an eating disorder look like, or what might be some of those tendencies?
I think it's really important to point out before we go into that, that eating disorders are a very complex condition that impair so psychosocial functioning. And they are difficult to diagnose because they do look so different for everyone. And they're very easy to hide because there's so much shame associated with an eating disorder. So really, disordered eating or an eating disorder is really a disordered relationship with food. So there is a wide range or spectrum of your relationships with food, ranging from, you know, an acute stage where you need medical intervention versus, you know, a relationship with food where you're just, all you want is to get your adequate nutrition. There's an immense gray area in between, of course. And so I think that a majority of North Americans kind of fall into that slight preoccupation with food. Am I eating healthy? Am I doing this? Am I doing that? But really, an acute eating disorder is a preoccupation with food that becomes incredibly limiting and in many cases antisocial.
I've noticed, like, personally, sometimes I will skip out on events because of, like, the food that's involved. I won't go to a family dinner because it's at a restaurant that I know has a high caloric option. I don't know. So I really appreciate you saying that. Abby, I'm curious if you'd be comfortable sharing how you got to recognize eating disordered habits in yourself.
Yeah, honestly, I didn't recognize it for a long time because so many of my behaviors were praised. Like Caroline said, it's very masking at times. So things like restriction looked like discipline, or as a triathlete, spending hours of training looked like commitment. And being, like you said, highly controlled around food is often seemed as committed to health. But really looking back, especially in the military culture, it's maybe unintentionally reinforced some of those beliefs, especially with fitness standards, high performance, or the theory of pushing through discomfort as being a part of the job. So for people like me who's vulnerable to an eating disorder, it's very easy for unhealthy behaviors to hide behind what's celebrated as dedication. But eventually I realized that it really wasn't about the eating. It was so much about the space that the eating disorder occupied in my life. And so I planned my days around food and negotiated a lot of those meals and felt anxious when plans changed, and really just tied my worth to whether I'd follow my own rules. And so my world slowly became smaller, like we mentioned. And I had a provider mention to me, you know, functioning doesn't mean that you're free. It means that, you know, you don't have to look sick for your pain to be real. So it was through a lot of really good, trusted people in my life, and also specifically my team that I had to help me really realize that I had something that I needed to address.
Talk about your team a little bit. What does that look like for you?
It first started with my therapist, who referred me to a nutritionist. And from there, my nutritionist gave me actually Akita's website to look at different eating disorder informed providers who were able to know what an eating disorder looked like and sounded like. Because the thing about working within the healthcare profession, we don't have set classes where we know what eating disorders really look like. It can look like, we said, a variety of things. And so having a provider that was eating disorder informed was really crucial for me taking next steps to get in resident help for that.
Caroline, I'm curious if there's anything you want to add about or regarding that, or is it harder for people to come to terms with the fact that they have an eating disorder because it's all of the stigma around it?
I think Abby's experience is really sort of epitomizes what happens for a lot of people, that it's actually even hard to recognize because you think you're doing the right thing. You're either eating healthy or you're eating less, or you're exercising a lot. And it's only when you become literally obsessed and plan your whole life around either whatever activity that then is identified as that eating disorder, you really cannot tell if somebody has an eating disorder based on their body size or a person's appearance or anything like that. So
talk about that a little bit more, because I think it's really easy to label somebody based off of the way that their body looks or doesn't look, or give them advice based on just looking at them.
Right. And I think that is a leading question for what we're going to get into a little later in the show. But, you know, I think that, I'm 56. I was influenced by the 80s and 90s and the heroin chic of the 90s, and we're just we're so conditioned to think about bodies in a certain way, and now even more so with the male athletic body or whatever it is, that if somebody's too thin now, you either think, oh, they've got an eating disorder, or, oh, look at them, they're so disciplined. And so I don't know, and some people are just naturally thin. And so, I mean, everybody's body comes in a different shape and naturally a different size, and we don't celebrate that enough. And so it is very hard to be compassionate towards people, whether they do or they don't have an eating disorder.
You mentioned 80s, 90s, heroin chic. I was born in 2001. I feel like I kind of grew up with the cell phone and social media. And I feel like, from my perspective, social media has changed the way eating disorders are talked about and operate. Has social media changed the landscape at all for eating disorders?
I think yes and no. I mean, we are always peer influenced, and it's social media has taken over from magazines and music videos. But I do think that the peer influence is probably the worst of it. The problem with social media is now we're seeing auto-tuned or AI images, which are just even more unobtainable, and it's a 24/7 cycle, and our brain chemistry is literally changing because of social media. So I think it's a yes, but I'm sad to think that I thought people's awareness around body image and body autonomy had evolved, and yet we're still being controlled by this idea that the only good body is a skinny body.
Abby, has social media changed your relationship with recovery or food at all?
Absolutely. I think, you know, growing up alongside social media, I don't think many of us really realized how much of those messages are really shaping our beliefs about ourselves. And I think from a cultural point of view as well, we're constantly exposed to these messages telling us that our worth is tied to our appearance, or I don't know, maybe it's our productivity or ability to optimize ourselves to be the best version of ourselves. And so I think for me, those messages are really easy to internalize, especially if you're already vulnerable to maybe an eating disorder or disordered eating, whatever it is. And the algorithms are really designed to capture our attention, like Caroline mentioned, and not about protecting our well-being at all. So for me, I've really learned to be intentional about what I allow into my mind, to my space, and from a peer point of view, just having those really open, honest, and sometimes tough discussions as well.
We're not exactly in the prime holiday season, but holidays for me are always a really hard time. And like I said, like, I've skipped events because of the calories surrounding a meal. And so for me, even thinking about November and December, just, I don't even want to think about that. I'm curious what if both of you have tips about, you know, this conversation in terms of holidays. Caroline, I don't know if you want to start, or
actually I'll ask if Abby wants to go.
Yeah, I think what sticks out to me, or the first thing that comes to mind, is that there's no morality around food, and we don't have to wait until a certain time of year to consume different desserts or treats or things that come up from, you know, different cultures share meals during those times. And so for me, I don't really have to earn or wait till a specific time of year. You know, it can just be like any other day. It's about balance and moderation. So just enjoying and being present, I think, is the most important thing, and not holding ourselves to this, you know, needing to earn or, you know, navigate that terrain with such strict nature or control, you know.
Caroline?
I agree that holidays are difficult, and because it's so food focused. However, I think there's always an opportunity to go to an event with the mindset that you're just there to celebrate people. And so we can celebrate food for what it really is, which is something that nurtures our body. And we don't have to label foods as good or bad. Dessert's not bad. No foods are bad. Just like no bodies are bad. And so I think if to kind of navigate that landscape with that perspective of, I'm here to enjoy and celebrate the season and the people and not get so hung up with food is the goal. And I realize that that is still going to be a struggle for many, many people.
Switching your mindset, though, is not as easy as just, I guess, like, so let's say I'm struggling with that in the moment. Do you have any tips on how to turn those thoughts off or maybe redirect toward community and people?
I'll start with saying very clearly that I am not a therapist. So just speaking from my own experience is really just taking that moment to take a deep breath and turn away from a table or just turn towards something that somebody that you know is compassionate and caring and you can engage in good conversation with. And it's also really okay to just take a break and go to the bathroom or go and sit in a room or leave. But I think when we restrict our lives based on food, I mean, we have to eventually kind of work through that because that's the piece that becomes so problematic in our life.
Abby, do you have any other tips to add to make those situations more manageable?
Yeah, I think those situations are really difficult at times when it feels overwhelming. And what I notice is, you know, when those moments are feeling very overwhelming, not to let the maybe eating disorder voice have the final say. So it's not just the initial thought that comes up, it's how we're navigating those moments. And so I use the good old trusted opposite action if you have access to it, and to just say to myself, you know, I don't have to earn something to consume it, or, you know, I can be in community with friends or family, safe, trusted people. And it's not just about the food in this moment.
And before we head into a quick break, I'm curious if there's any misconceptions surrounding eating disorders that come to mind that you guys think we should break down for listeners.
I think for a long time, people have thought of it as a wealthy young white woman's disease, and it's certainly not. I mean, we see it affecting all genders, all ages, all ethnicities, and frankly, athletes, people from the LGBTQIA plus community, and as Abby mentioned, military are honestly disproportionately affected.
Abby, anything that you'd like to add?
I think other than one of the biggest misconceptions is that the eating disorder has a certain look. I think maybe another misconception is that eating disorders are about vanity to some degree. And I think in reality, they're just incredibly complex illnesses that are influenced by, you know, the biology, psychology, environmental, oftentimes trauma. You know, many people aren't just trying to become thin. They're really trying to feel safe or worthy and control. And so I think one of the most compassionate questions we can ask isn't what's wrong with this person, but really, you know, whether, you know, what has this person been through or how has this eating disorder or disorder eating been trying to help them survive?
Yeah. And thank you guys so much for, you guys are handling this in such like a calm, collected way. I was really nervous to have this conversation just because there is so much stigma around eating disorders, and it's hard to talk on the air about how I have struggled with food before, but you guys are making me feel very safe, and I really appreciate that, so thank you. You're listening to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. This is a pre-recorded show, so you can't call in or share your questions, but I'm so glad that you're listening, and after this short break, we're going to get into how to support loved ones experiencing and recovering from eating disorders.
Alaska Public Media is now partnering with an Alaskan auction service so a helpful local team can get the biggest return for the least hassle should you decide to donate your vehicle. Learn more at alaskapublic.org/vehicle.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your guest host, Ava White. Joining me today is Caroline Storm. She's on the board for the Alaska Eating Disorder Alliance, or AKEDA. Also with us is Abby Kuhn. She shared with us her experience about recovering from an eating disorder. We're talking about the impacts of disordered eating, and now we're getting into learning more about how to support loved ones and how you can start having those tough conversations. Caroline, how do you tell someone that you're concerned about their eating?
That is a really tough question because there's so much shame and stigma around having an eating disorder that I think it can often be perceived as a challenge rather than concern. So these are really tough conversations. And so I think if you're honestly concerned about somebody's or somebody having an eating disorder, look for resources first before you tackle that question. So we have resources on the Alaska Eating Disorders website, and it needs to be dealt with and approached with an incredibly compassionate stance. And I think you can ask a question before coming to any conclusion.
Abby, how do you think is the right way to start that conversation if you're worried about someone else in your life?
I think those conversations can be really difficult. I know firsthand personally, one of the biggest things that I've learned is that healing happens in safe relationships. And for a long time, my eating disorder convinced me that I had to carry it alone. But really, recovery showed me that when I began to trust people and allow them into my story, I didn't have as much shame. And that's a big factor. And shame, I think, grows in that secrecy of the eating disorder, but really loses its power when we're met with that compassion, like Caroline mentioned. And so I think it's just starting from that compassionate lens and knowing that sometimes it's not always the first conversation that might make the biggest impact. It's having that relationship cultivated over time.
Caroline, is there ever a wrong time, a wrong way, a wrong person to be the one to have that conversation?
Probably. And yet, I think if you are honest in your concern and you're approaching that conversation with compassion, without trying to find a solution for the person you're concerned about immediately, that can go a long way. So maybe saying approaching a conversation with curiosity rather than a kind of hierarchical, you need to get better mindset.
Abby, do you think that there's a wrong way or time to speak up?
I don't know if there's ever a wrong time or wrong way. There's definitely ways to navigate the tough conversation. I think the biggest thing is not making it just on the appearance, because there's so much that's happening underneath that sometimes it can get lost in that. Or sometimes, you know, I would carry shame about different behaviors and try to modulate that based off of who I'm in front of, so it doesn't appear as apparent. So I think it's just operating from that compassionate lens and being a safe person to come back to.
And I pulled some numbers from Akita before we got started. Nearly 10% of Alaskans will experience a diagnosable eating disorder, and the 2023 Youth Risk Behavior Survey found that nearly half of teens are engaging in eating disorder behaviors, which is really concerning to me. I was shocked by that number, and I think diagnosable is a really big word there. I'm curious what both of you think about the current state of eating disorder culture and the impacts it's having on the current generation, but the next generation. Caroline, if you want to start.
There's definitely a rising concern, a health concern for our youth, our kids, again, based in social media and peer influence, because we tend to replicate what our peers are doing. And so that is predominantly why the Alaska Eating Disorders Alliance launched the Building Confident Kids program, so we can teach educators in schools how to relate to kids and teach them about all bodies are good bodies. Prevention and intervention are the obvious best tools that we have.
Abby, I know that you have a little baby at home, so I'm especially curious to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, you know, I have both hope and concern as well. I'm definitely encouraged that conversations around mental health are becoming more open and people are seeking help earlier. I think that's amazing. But, you know, at the same time, young people are growing up in a world where we're constantly comparing themselves to the curated images that we're seeing on social media and receiving those endless messages about changing their bodies before they maybe figured out who they are. They're being told who they should become. And so, you know, as a parent, I just hope that teaching our children that worth never really dependent on how they look or their appearance, and helping to build the emotional resilience, you know, using media and literacy and self-compassion, they may be some of the most powerful forms of prevention that we have.
Abby, again, I really appreciate you sharing your story. I'm a little bit curious if you could talk a little bit more about how you see your life now.
I think before I recognized that a lot of my life was consumed by this identity as an eating disorder. And now I'm realizing that it's not just the eating disorder that's a part of me. I have so many other parts to offer. And so realizing that I can show up and have good relationships and be an asset to other people in my line of work and be a beacon of hope for other people, it's allowed me to come outside of this small little lens of an eating disorder and have such a bigger life than I ever imagined.
Caroline, have you noticed any changes in yourself?
I've been in recovery for almost 25 years, so it is a long road, and I would say that body dysmorphia is always something that I am struggling with, and that is because of social media. I mean, even though I know better and I can talk my way, you know, in my own head, talk my way out of it and question the way I'm thinking and turn towards my partner, who's incredibly supportive. It's such a long road, and the images we consume in social media become so deeply entrenched in our psyches. So I am worried about our kids, but there is hope as we continue to question what we're being inundated with.
And now we're going to add another layer. GLP-1s are popular. And before we get into it, I should tell listeners what GLP-1 medications are. GLP-1 stands for glucagon-like peptide 1 and was originally developed to manage blood sugar levels for people with type 2 diabetes. And now the Food and Drug Administration has approved it for weight loss for people who are obese. But now these medications have become known for promoting weight loss, even for people who aren't obese. In February, NPR did a story on the topic, and I'm going to play a quick clip of that. Here's NPR correspondent Yuki Noguchi.
For people who struggle with disordered eating, GLP-1 drugs can be a complicating factor. They're easy to obtain online with little screening. About a tenth of people will develop clinical eating disorders at some point, but far more have problem relationships with eating and body weight. Yet little is known about how GLP-1 use or misuse affects those who binge or restrict food, despite the prevalence of those behaviors. Psychologist Robin Pashby sits on the board of the Obesity Action Coalition, a patient advocacy group. She says most patients aren't even evaluated for these disorders when prescribed GLP-1 drugs.
We're at a point where we need to hold two truths, that GLP-1s are legitimate evidence-based treatments for obesity, but that they also sit inside our culture, which has intense weight pressure, weight stigma, and eating disorder risk.
That was a clip of a recent NPR story on GLP-1s and their impact on people with disordered eating. Caroline, can you take me through the timeline of what Akita has been hearing and noticing regarding GLP-1s as they've gained popularity? You can pick a timeline over the last 6 months, year, 2 years.
Well, I can say that I started on the board of Akita 4 years ago, and it was barely on our radar. It was just coming into focus that people were starting to ask for GLP-1s when they didn't need it. And it was not part of our strategic planning. It was not really something we needed to address. And here we are just 4 short years later, and we are now centering this this problem, I'll call it a problem, or this concern with GLP-1s in our fall conference. And so we've entitled that GLP-1s and Health in All Sizes, Collaborative and Affirming Eating Disorder Care for Every Body. So in that very short window, it's gone from peripheral to a central concern for us. We want providers to have the information to actually screen for eating disorders before they prescribe such impactful medication. It really has to be an individual conversation. There needs to be a timeline and a goal and a pathway for maintenance, and not just what we're seeing now, which is people's unfettered access to a medication that they are not taking as prescribed or not even getting the correct prescription for, and it's leading to dramatically weight loss without any kind of oversight. I think the problem is how many people are able to obtain this online without any actual medical consultation and strategy.
And you mentioned that this is going to be the theme of your fall conference?
Yes.
When is that?
September 25th and 26th, and if you're interested, you could pop onto our website and take a look at what we have to offer during that conference.
I've definitely noticed a huge change in my social media feeds. I've blocked words from showing up in my feed, but I still get ads for GLP-1s all the time. They become unavoidable. Abby, I'm curious if from a consumer perspective, if you've also noticed a change in how these are being marketed to you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, like you said, it's important to acknowledge that these medications have legitimate medical uses and continue to help many people. But what's been really difficult from a recovery perspective isn't necessarily the medication itself. It's the cultural messaging that's surrounding it. You know, 2 years ago, it was much more difficult to access these medications, especially from an online point of view without seeing a provider. But like I said, I think we can hold up both truths that we're returning to this conversation where weight loss is often celebrated as the ultimate marker of health. And it's so accessible that, you know, recovering from an eating disorder or maybe having this underlying disordered eating could be difficult, especially when you're on these medications.
I'm curious to hear what both of you think of this, and I don't know the answer. Why is social media culture like so tied to how we look? Is that just, I don't know if either of you guys have any opinions, but like, why is it like this in the first place is what I'm thinking.
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say, historically, the attention to initially just women's bodies was very classist, right? If you could afford to be very clean and very either well-fed or skinny, it was a marker of your status. And we don't have those status markers anymore, yet I do think that it is a way to control the way people feel and look and keep people distracted from literally just living their lives the way they want to live their lives.
Yeah.
And there's just too much money to be made off of these products, honestly.
Caroline, have you seen or heard about GLP-1s or the conversations around them triggering relapses in Alaskans or...
There's no data on this yet. I will tell you that I have one anecdotal conversation that I had with somebody who was too scared to take GLP-1s, even though it could have helped them, legitimately could have helped them medically, because they were scared that they were going to relapse. And that's maybe not exactly what you're talking about, but there are concerns. And I do think that it would be very easy for people to just stop eating when you're taking these medications, which is what I was saying earlier, when they're not actually prescribed properly. And if you're not being monitored by a physician, it's very easy to or take too high of a dose and simply stop eating.
Yeah. Abby, has the broader cultural conversation around GLP-1s, and you talked about this a little bit a minute ago, but has it ever felt destabilizing in your recovery?
I think there's definitely been moments where it's felt incredibly activating in my recovery, especially in the postpartum season when your body has changed and you feel different, you look different. And I think it's really required me to lean on the support system that I have so far and really go back and connect to my values and lean into that system and remind myself that recovery has given me far more than what the eating disorder ever could. And so going back to that would be really destructive for recovery.
And there's numerous studies that show GLP-1 drugs can do more than help people lose weight. They can curb substance use disorders, which is a huge deal. And I think it's really important to highlight the medical uses. But although substance use and eating disorders aren't the same type of illness at all, Caroline, I'm curious how, if you've thought at all about how to balance those pros and cons.
I would challenge you first by saying substance use and eating disorders psychologically do fall into a similar space of a way to control what feels out of control, or a way to, in fact, escape what feels out of control. So back to your original question about balancing pros and cons or pros and risks, that is a conversation you need to have with a trusted medical provider, because when we're self-prescribing, just because it's so accessible, I don't think we have enough of a self-awareness. I'm talking about average person doesn't have enough self-awareness to really understand what the impacts are going to be for them and their lifestyle and their body.
And sticking with you, Caroline, we heard it in the NPR story, but are providers routinely screening for eating disorder history, and should they be?
No, they're not screening, unfortunately. And that is a huge generalization, and I realize that. Not enough providers are actually screening. And that is one of the reasons we want to have the conference in the fall, because this is the conversation we need to be bringing to the attention of providers. And they should be screening, because everybody's body is going to respond differently to this medication. There's no standard initial dose that should be followed. It should be adjusted over the course of how you're using it. And if you have an eating disorder, that needs to be... If you have an eating disorder, or you're recovering from an eating disorder, that definitely needs to be monitored while you're taking the medication.
It kind of reminds me of like the Sackler opioid like time. I don't know if that, yeah.
That resonates with me for sure.
Abby, I don't know if you have any thoughts to add about the importance of providers screening for GLP-1s.
I think as a healthcare worker myself, I feel for providers because there are so many moving parts to already be looking for and so many standards with insurance companies and all of that. And so I think it's just a very hard terrain to navigate. And I would just look at, you know, what is the long-term goal and how is this sustainable over the continuum? Because it's not only helping from a physiological point of view, there also has to be a mental intervention as well, because it's not just about the body. And that's what the medication does. It helps from the physiological point of view, but it's not helping everything that's going on in that underlying mental space.
And I misspoke. I meant to say, should they be screening for eating disorder history, not, yeah. Anyway, thank you. We're going to head into another quick break. You're listening to Lyme One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. This is a pre-recorded show, so you're not able to call in and share your questions, but thank you so much for listening. After the short break, we're going to get into how to have a relationship with media that supports healthy relationships with food and our bodies.
Alaska Public Media is now partnering with an Alaskan auction service, so a helpful local team can get the biggest return for the least hassle should you decide to donate your vehicle. Learn more at alaskapublic.org/vehicle.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your guest host, Ava White. Joining me today is Caroline Storm, Executive Director for Akita, and Abby Kuhn. We're talking about the intersection of GLP-1s and eating disorders and the complex impacts that these medications can have on people with disordered eating, but now we're going to get into how to create a healthy media diet. Personally, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, I have really noticed the increase of GLP-1s on my social media feeds with celebrities promoting them. I get them on my Facebook. I feel like I sometimes even get them in my email. Like I've said, I blocked words from popping up in my feed, which helps, but how have you guys changed how you're intaking social media right now with this crazy landscape? Abby, we'll start with you first.
Talk algorithm just drops me off anywhere. So I really feel like I've had to cultivate my social media. It feels almost like my home. So I get to decide what I allow into that space. So I've had to unfollow a lot of accounts that consistently leave me feel like I'm inadequate or blocked from certain advertisements, and intentionally fill my feed with voices that really encourage recovery or curiosity and authenticity, which is what I really want to become more of. So setting those boundaries with social media for me isn't avoidance. It's really just recognizing that recovery deserves an environment really supportive of healing.
And Caroline?
Well said, Abby, first of all. And I think I take a slightly different approach to social media. I unfortunately spend a lot of time on there because of my involvement in other things. And I like to see what people are seeing. And so I don't unfollow ads, and I don't try and curate my social media that intentionally, but I do balance what I see with, you know, content creators that are being very real about living your best life and being authentic and not falling prey to all these ridiculous beauty standards that, you know, have been now around for 35, 40 years that we can never obtain. So I just try and balance it. And I also continually remind myself that half of what I'm looking at is not real.
Caroline, I'm curious if you could talk a bit about how this drug is being advertised directly to consumers.
I'm not sure I can answer that outside of just social media, because that's where I see it. Yeah. And occasionally online, you know, pop-up ads and stuff, but I have those blocked. So I don't see a lot of pop-up ads when I'm just on my computer. On my phone, on social media, you know, I see I guess, when you're streaming and you don't have an ad-free subscription, you're seeing it a lot there, like the Wegovy ads, which I guess I could probably sing that silly little theme song in my head. It's just this constant portrayal that this is the best thing you can do for yourself, and that, oh, on this drug, I feel so much better. It's not all that different to the lifestyle that's portrayed in alcohol ads, you know, like living the best life. Look at me. Doesn't my life look amazing because I'm drinking this one drink? And all these ads are, I'm doing great because now I'm on a GLP-1.
I haven't even thought about that, but that makes so much sense. And like the activities that they're doing in that, it all plays a bigger picture for sure.
Like, you can do this if you're just on a GLP-1, which you could probably do anyway. It's just the way that marketing works is convincing you of something that you possibly don't really need. I also, anecdotally, unfortunately, a friend told me that their provider just suggested they go on a GLP-1, and she was very upset about it. And they, you know, so it's being pushed by providers, and she doesn't need to be on one, and she was quite offended by the suggestion.
Yeah.
And this is not somebody who even appears heavy. So it's very disconcerting what even providers, and Abby, no shade thrown at you. I think there are certain providers who just think, well, doesn't everybody want to be on these just to lose 10 pounds, you know, even though You don't really need to lose that 10 pounds.
For providers listening, the answer is no. Not everybody wants that. Abby, what has been helpful for you to keep at the forefront of your mind as this situation just like rapidly evolves? And you've talked about the way that you go about your day-to-day life differently and how you just like view it in a whole different lens. But yeah, I don't know. What do you find helpful in those moments when those ads are targeting you?
Yeah, sometimes it can get really loud out there. It almost feels like there's peer pressure coming from all ends, especially social media, from a societal point of view. And so when it comes to that, I really just try to look at what recovery has given me and stay grounded in my values and realizing that recovery has taught me that healing isn't about never feeling fear. It's about, you know, continuing to choose your values over those fears one decision at a time. So for each ad that comes up or for each conversation, it's just one decision at a time.
And Abby, you mentioned your support system a little bit at the very beginning, but I think it's so important to have safe people in your life, people that you trust, that you can talk to about these things, because your body is so personal and it's just, yeah, it's hard to talk about. I would like to hear from both of you, but how do you go about finding those safe connections? And I'm curious what makes a person quote unquote safe to you. Abby, if you want to start.
Yeah, for me, I think of my spouse as a really big advocate and supporter for me. And it's just about having those real, authentic conversations, not someone that is just going to promote any thought that comes up or, you know, really be permissive to a lot of things. I think it's about finding people that are able to have those hard and challenging conversations, but also see you for where you're at in that day and be able to be authentic in those conversations. I think that's incredibly important.
And Caroline?
I'd echo Abby and also just say that, safety with somebody is somebody who's also not only not being permissive, but not dismissive of the feelings you're having. Because again, there's so much shame, there's so much stigma. It takes a long time to learn to just love your body for what it is and what it can do. And so when you say to somebody, I'm feeling X or Y, and they're dismissive of it, that feels very threatening and can cause somebody to sort of retract and trigger old behaviors. So somebody who, I mean, I know it sounds so cliche, but really just loves all of you, and not everybody in the world has that connection, I realize. But it does take those vulnerable relationships to be able to talk through the pain and the challenges of what you're going through and then move on to healing.
When it comes to health, fitness, and food, who do you guys go to as like trusted resources? Abby?
For me, I really rely on my eating disorder informed nutritionist to help me with the food aspect. I think that's where I can stem out to the fitness realm and know that when I'm honest about what I'm doing in the gym or outside, I can really nourish and replenish myself with the nutritionist. So I think having that aspect of a team and having a therapist that has been really helpful. So I think it's a whole collective team approach. It's not just one person. But that's really made all the difference for me.
One thing that you guys have both talked about, and I think it's really important, and something I did not realize when I was like getting started in my recovery, I didn't realize it was a journey. I thought I was going to be able to just kind of like change the way I think, and then next week on Monday, I'll wake up and I'll be able to eat 3 meals a day, and yay. It's not that way. And I've found that it kind of comes in waves. And right now, with social media and Ozempic, honestly, I'm kind of on a down low right now. But I'm curious, Caroline, if you'd like to start, because I'm inspired that, like you said, like over 2 decades of recovery is a long time. And as someone that's very daunting thinking about dealing with these feelings for the next two decades of my life. How do you set yourself up for a long-term journey?
Wow, that was a long pause, and I apologize for that. Recovery from anything is not a straight line. And so you're definitely going to have highs and lows, whether it's recovery from eating disorder or addiction or grief. There's going to be long periods where you feel okay, and then there's going to be some bumpy patches or some low patches. And definitely not the way to look at it is go, well, Caroline says she still has body dysmorphia after 20 years. That, I don't want to, you know, don't think about that. Just think about it as, what am I doing today to feel good about me? And I also don't want to promote, sugarcoating it. It's going to be a challenge, and we're always going to be inundated with images and thoughts of maybe lack of confidence or whatever, and fall into behavior. Well, if I just eat a little less or do something, you know, but these are manufactured standards. So I think staying in the day-to-day, trusting your body to tell you when it's hungry or what it needs, and giving yourself some grace.
And Abby, I don't know exactly the timeline of when you started your recovery journey, but how did you prepare yourself for that? And how are you thinking of, I don't know, the years to come?
I think the first thing that comes to mind when you ask that question is when I first entered residential treatment, I was asking the therapist, I'm like, how long does it take to recover from this? Very blindly and hopeful. And she was like, you know, it can take anywhere from 5 to 7 years to feel like you're having a good recovery underneath you. And that felt extremely daunting. She compared it that, you know, recovering from an eating disorder is not like recovering from drugs or alcohol. It's not abstinence-based. So you can't just stop doing something and walk away. It's very much of a journey. And so I think just cultivating that community around you, it's been really difficult and very trying at times, especially with all seasons going through pregnancy and body changes. And, you know, my body will continue to change as I grow and evolve. But realizing that my worth isn't tied to just this earth suit that I'm living in. It's just allowing me to have this human experience.
Yeah. And Abby, I think I have said this to you before, but it's like your body is a vessel. And once you think of it as like, I wouldn't be able to do anything without this vessel, and I get to drive it every day. So thank God, right? I'm curious, Caroline, what you might say to someone who might be listening and might be wanting to reach out for help, but is scared to take that first step. Any advice?
Yeah. Look at some resources on the internet. Again, I'm going to promote Akita because we worked really hard to make sure that our resources are clinical and evidence-based. Be curious. Honestly, nobody that is going to help you try to recover from eating disorder is going to be judgmental. And although recovery from an eating disorder can be terrifying because it's the thing that you use to feel safe, there are so many people out there just wanting to help you and wanting to walk you through what the steps are to move on from this.
Abby, any advice for someone who might be ready to take that first step?
The first thing that comes to mind is that you don't have to reach some imaginary level of suffering before you deserve help. You know, oftentimes the eating disorders are invisible. So, like I said before, someone can appear incredibly successful, capable, or their life is still functioning. But, you know, if food or movement or your body is something that's really consuming your life, your struggle is real. And you deserve support, you know, exactly where you are today. And there is so much life waiting on the other side of an eating disorder. And I hope anyone listening knows that they don't have to walk the path alone.
Abby, how have you learned to advocate for yourself in like the medical space?
It's incredibly difficult. I've had a lot of fierce advocators for me that have given me a voice when I felt small or inadequate or insufficient. And that has gotten me to where I am today, especially in the military space. That was a very tough organization to navigate the world of recovery. But there were people in the organization that believes that recovery is possible and push that stigma aside and really invested in me. And so I just want to give back to those people who have made an incredible impact on my life.
Yeah, and thank you both again so much for talking with me. I've been so excited to have this conversation. But before we wrap up, I want to leave some time for last minute thoughts. Caroline, anything you think we should chat about?
An eating disorder does not make you broken. It's just part of who you are right now. And, for health reasons, I think it's important to move on from that. There are people that can help you.
Abby, anything else?
I just appreciate you having the courage to have the conversation. I know it's not always an easy one, and hopefully it can touch another person.
Oh, and where can we find Akita?
We do not have a physical office. We do have a website, akeatingdisordersalliance.org.
And you're on social media.
We are on social media.
That's how I found you guys when I was like 18 years old. And I remember I followed you guys, and my thought to it was a big deal for me, because me following you guys was like a public admission to myself that I was struggling. And it was like, wow, everybody can see I follow you guys. And yeah, I've followed you ever since. So thank you guys for your work. And thank you both, thank you to our guests, Caroline Storm and Abby Kuhn. Just a reminder of some other resources for in your community and around the state. If you're in a mental health crisis, you can call 988. And if you need help finding the right treatment for you or a loved one, you can call the National Alliance for Eating Disorders at 1-866-662-1235. Thank you so much to our audio engineer, Crystal Hyde, and our producer, Rachel Cassandra. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website, alaskapublic.org. Tell us your thoughts or suggestions by emailing line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your guest host, Ava White. Thank you.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants, and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.